From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Although she's lived abroad most of her life, Gaza is where journalist and activist Leila El-Haddad calls home. Growing up, and as an adult, she would visit Gaza to spend time with her extended family. She also spent years reporting on the region for Al Jazeera. During that time, she launched the blog Gaza Mom, which she eventually turned into a book of the same name. In 2012, she co-wrote the cookbook, The Gaza Kitchen, which was republished a few years ago in an updated third edition. Most recently, Leila has written an essay for Savour, A Cuisine Under Siege, about keeping her family's recipes alive, as well as an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times about trying to find solace during this year's Ramadan. Hi, Leila. Welcome to Good Food.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about your family background. Where are your parents and grandparents from?
My parents are both from Gaza, born and raised in Gaza City and southern Gaza's town of Khan Yunis, respectively. My mother's maternal grandfather was Circassian, who was part of a persecuted group of Muslims from Sochi, and he married my great-grandmother, who herself was Kurdish from Damascus, and they had my grandmother, who was born in Palestine. And my parents both met in Gaza as newly minted doctors after finishing medical school, got married there, and eventually moved first to England and then to the Gulf, Kuwait, and then Saudi Arabia.
And so where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Kuwait, though I don't remember it much. I only spent a few months there of my life before my parents then moved to Saudi Arabia, where they worked as physicians in the town of Dhahran on the eastern part of the country. And that's where I was largely raised while summering in Gaza. So we would commute back there on a yearly basis to see our family and renew our residency documents and so on, since we only had Palestinian documents.
And where did you end up living as an adult? Did you come to the U.S. for college?
I did. I came here when I was 18. I finished high school in Bahrain, also in the Gulf, and then I came to study in North Carolina. I went to Duke and continued that journey of going back and forth until I finally decided to move back to Gaza with my young son in 2003.
And where are you living now?
Right now, I'm in Maryland, so about 40 minutes away from Washington.
After leaving Gaza, how did your family maintain a connection to the place?
I don't think that they thought too intentionally about it, honestly, especially in the 70s and 80s, it was a time when a lot of Palestinians, especially Palestinian professionals, were being recruited by these young countries in the Gulf. Palestinians had the highest rate of education in the region. And so you had doctors and engineers and others all going in you know, masses to the Gulf. And I think really it was their main concern was about raising their families, securing their children's futures. Most of us were stateless. Some people managed to get foreign passports, but the overwhelming majority of the Palestinian community was stateless and, you know, at best might have had temporary travel documents or the like. Many of them even got a little too comfortable and lost their ability to return to Palestine, you know, not by their own choosing, but Israel made it extremely difficult for Palestinians who might have been living abroad to retain their residency status through this process, through a permit that that they issue called a Hawiya or an identity document. At that point in time, if you didn't renew the Hawiya on a regular basis, it would be withdrawn from you and you just immediately lost your ability to return, to visit, to reside in your own home. And that happened to a lot of Palestinians who happened to be working abroad in 1967 when Israel formally occupied the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So for my parents, Their main concern was retaining their residency in Palestine, raising their family, and securing their futures. And so it was really difficult. And I think the burden does fall on the parents. But again, they were both working professionals who didn't have much time to think about how they might teach us our own history. Every now and then there was a cultural event. We would, put on our embroidered dresses. We would certainly go and visit. That was very important to them. And that was something I'm very grateful that my mother made sure to do, whereas a lot of other families either didn't really put much time or thought into it or weren't very intentional about it. But she insisted that we had to make this really perilous, daunting, and tortuous journey every year back to Palestine. And as kids, you don't fully appreciate that. It was really we'd have to go cross the land crossing from Jordan into Palestine. And this would take more than 24 hours. We would be made to wait by the Israeli soldiers in buses for hours on end in the middle of the summer heat. We would then be separated, men and women, strip searched, be told to take off our shoes and our socks. They would be thrown into large piles that we would then be told in large groups to go and retrieve while we were still naked. And so those kinds of experiences don't encourage someone, especially a child, you don't associate going back home with any pleasant memories because of that. But she kept insisting, we have to do this. We have to go back. This is your country. These are your family. And, again, it's only when you grow and mature, you begin to appreciate and understand that despite all of the odds and everything, all these Israeli policies that were very much intending to make this experience, this journey home, as uncomfortable and unpleasant as possible, she persisted and insisted that we had to go back.
Did food help connect you to your Palestinian identity and sort of attenuate the feeling of disconnection that you had?
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think that was something my parents necessarily thought of at the time. My mother cooked because she had to, but she was very busy. She noticed that I really enjoyed being in the kitchen and enjoyed cooking, and she certainly encouraged that. And was certainly cooking the foods that were familiar, especially to my father, who was from Gaza City, which even in a place as small as the Gaza Strip, which is just twice the size of Washington, D.C., there is a lot of regional and micro-regional variation in the food. Some of my earliest memories are of going fishing with my father, not in Gaza, but in off the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, and we would fish for grouper and crabs. And then we would go home and he would show me how they prepared the crabs in Gaza growing up, how he made them, something with which my mother was wholly unfamiliar. She would show me how they would make sayadia, fish and rice, with a grouper that we would catch. And my father would show me how to clean the crabs and then stuff them with mashed garlic and cumin, chili peppers and parsley and olive oil, and how you would either roast them in the oven or grill them. And that was certainly one of my earliest, food-related memories. And I remember thinking, God, this is amazing. But I didn't know anyone else who knew how to make crabs this way. It's funny because I live in Maryland now, which is, of course, famous for its blue crabs. And I like to joke that there's some kind of parallel in terms of where I now reside and where I'm from in terms of the love of crabs.
Can you describe either a flavor palette or a particular set of techniques that distinguishes Gazan cooking as a distinct subset of Palestinian cuisine?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that some of the most familiar ingredients, or as you said, flavor palette, is the use of cumin, chili peppers, garlic, and dill seeds. You see this combination in a large majority of the dishes there. And in terms of the technique, it's the use of the unglazed clay mortar and lemon wood pestle known as the zabdiya. The clay mortar itself is known as the zabdiya. And it's ubiquitous. You'll see it in every household, urban, rural, rich or poor. And in fact, it was one of the only items that now in the modern day, Palestinians who are, being forcibly displaced from their homes are taking with them. I'm seeing it in a lot of social media reels, people in tents, and sometimes besides the mattresses and maybe a small backpack, the only other thing they'll have with them is this diya. And Gaza itself has a long and ancient history of pottery making, but the use of the zibdiya is pretty unique in Palestinian cuisine. It's used to not only to grind, coarsely grind spices like dill seed in a circular motion until it's kind of fragrant, you smell those essential oils, but it's also used to mash things like the garlic and then the green chili peppers, and to that is added lemon juice to make this kind of essential dressing that's put in lentil soup and rice and chicken dishes and so on. But the zibdiya is also used to bacon. So it's used to prep ingredients to serve salads like the quintessential Gazan salad called degga, which is chili peppers and dill seeds and green fresh dill and super overripe tomatoes, all slathered with olive oil. And it's also used to cook in. So there's a really famous shrimp, tomato-based shrimp stew called zibdiyat gambari. So literally shrimps in a clay pot or bowl that is cooked in this mortar and then served in it as well.
Food has such a sense memory for most of us. And as you write in your heartbreaking Savour essay, Gazan food for you is closely associated with your aunt, whom you call Hani. Tell us about her and what role she played with you as you went back and forth to visit in Gaza, and a little bit about the foods that she served you and maybe she taught you.
So growing up, I'd spend a lot of my time in Gaza, in my mother's hometown of Khan Yunis, visiting her family members, staying with my grandfather and grandmother. And we would only make brief visits to the city, which was about 40 minutes away, to see my father's family. And whenever we would do that, the first person to come and see us was Hani, my aunt. She would always come bearing one of my father's favorite dishes, either maftoul, which is the hand-rolled Palestinian version of couscous that is particularly well-known in Gaza and kind of cumbersome to make for, you know, families living a more modern lifestyle, or soumagiya, which is what I wrote about in that article, which is another kind of quintessentially Gaza City dish that is usually made around this time, the end of Ramadan, and to celebrate the Eid holiday. It's a stew of, you know, fork tender lamb cooked with chard and flavored with dill seeds and chili peppers and garlic and cumin, thickened with a roasted red sesame tahina and infused with this, what I call like a sumac tea or water. So boiled whole sumac berries or ground sumac, and it gives it a kind of pinkish ruby hue. And it's poured into bowls and usually distributed to family and friends and neighbors. And she would always come with a bowl of that when she came to visit us. And it wasn't until I had a chance to spend a more significant time in Gaza and go back and do the field work for my book, The Gaza Kitchen, in 2010, that I had a chance to sit down with her for many hours and record a very long interview with her in which she, you know, showed us, me and my co-author, how to make a variety of dishes, and there was kind of a lot of banter and conversation about the things that my grandmother liked and pictures of them in the, must have been the 1950s or the 1960s. And then I kind of just archived it, right? We had it transcribed and we used it for the purposes of the book, and we referred back to it every now and then when we were coming out with a new edition. But beyond that, it was archived. And it wasn't until I received the news that she was killed in an Israeli airstrike along with her two daughters, my cousins, and her eldest son and his wife, who was actually Croatian, that was sort of the first thing I thought about. I was having a conversation with my aunt's youngest granddaughter, who was in Austria, and she lost her mother, her father, her two aunts, and the grandmother, my aunt, who raised her. And so I immediately just was trying to problem solve and find a way to help my surviving cousin cope. And I thought of this interview, and I dug it up, and I started to kind of pour through it. And suddenly all of these seemingly trivial details took on new meaning, you know? And I was so thankful that I had this interview to not only share with my cousin, but to hear myself. And I just kind of kept thinking, I wish I had taken something with me from that house. I wish I had taken the pictures or done a better job of listening rather than interrupting. But it was Ramadan at the time. There was a heat wave. It was like maybe 110 degrees. It was almost time to break our fast. There was no electricity because of the Israeli attack at the time on the power plant and the restrictions on fuel. And so you can imagine it was sort of extreme conditions under which we were operating. And so I didn't really have much patience for anything further. We had spent several hours and she said to me, why don't I show you how to make somagiyah the way that your grandmother made it? And I was like, no, another time. Because I thought I knew it all. I had sort of a skeletal version of the recipe already. And that's sort of my one regret is that, you know, because another time, as I say in the article, never came. And I wished I had taken the time to say, you know, I would love to hear from you how she made it, or maybe you can show me how she made it.
As a food show, we look at the world through the lens of food, but what we've seen in Gaza is food become a weapon of starvation. And it's hard not to feel like cuisine is trivial in light of the suffering we're witnessing. Can you talk about why it's important for you, even amidst such horror, to keep these recipes alive?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I think about it a lot because, you know, food is kind of one of the ways at which I understand the world around me. And the way that I have certainly spent a lot of my time and my, you know, effort and work trying to share the story of Gaza and help people understand Gaza through this lens. And we had said before in the introduction to our book many years ago, and unfortunately this still holds true, that it seemed frivolous at the time to write a cookbook about Gaza, given all of the unimaginable horrors that it was enduring and that it was being subject to. That feeling is sort of increased tenfold, right, in the past 10 months. It leaves you struggling. And even as I am celebrating Ramadan with my own family every night, I tell them, I don't even want them to waste a morsel of food. And then, you know, of course, it's getting a little old for them. We know in Gaza, our relatives, I'm like, I know, but it's unfathomable that this could be happening, you know, in this day and age, at this scale, this fast. But I think it's for all those reasons, it's all the more important to be able to understand and speak about food, not only as a weapon of war, but as a tool of resistance and steadfastness and connection to the land. Certainly the way that Palestinians have always understood it.
That was author and activist Leila El Haddad discussing her essay, A Cuisine Under Siege, in Savour. For links to that piece and some of her other work, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, it all started with a vegan gumbo. How a revelation cooking with hearts of palm blossomed into a career as a vegan restaurateur. It's the story of Vegan Mob next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Toriano Gordon always had big dreams. He was either going to be a big-time rapper or a famous chef, but life got in the way. After a stint studying at Le Cordon Bleu in San Francisco, he ended up on the streets, fell into drugs, addiction, and even had a brush with death. But as he put his life back together, he and his wife decided to try veganism, even though he yearned to open a barbecue restaurant. That's how he launched Vegan Mob, initially selling plates from his car. Eventually, he opened a brick-and-mortar restaurant in Oakland. It was an instant sensation, drawing long lines, but closed in the fall of 2023. Gordon now has franchises in Oakland and San Francisco. He also has a cookbook, Vegan Mob, Vegan Barbecue and Soul Food. He spoke to us from a busy street in the Bay Area. Hi, Toriano.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing?
Good. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You grew up in San Francisco. Tell us about the neighborhood that you grew up in, kind of its history and how it shaped you.
Well, I grew up, I was born at UC Hospital, which is in the Haight and the Fillmore area, the Western Addition. The Haight was predominantly like black and mixed with like hippies. And further down where my grandmother was on my dad's side was more of the like the project areas. I grew up in a, you know, in a house. The neighborhood was nice, but more of the black culture was deeper into the Fillmore. So being that was my area and where my family was and where most of my friends were, I gravitated more to the street areas of that area. So it was a lot of culture, a lot of hip hop, a lot of jazz, just a lot of community that was going on, a lot of love. And really different than what it is right now. Just way different, like African and hip-hop stores and Jamaican food stores, and I miss it. And it also has a dark side, you know, a dangerous side. And I believe that's what kind of tore it apart.
So gentrification came in, right?
Gentrification came in, exactly.
That must be very demoralizing to watch a whole community held together by culture be torn apart.
Definitely. I mean, and we're still there. I mean, my mom has her house. My mom is the only black house that's left on the block right now. But it's just not the same as it used to be.
Let's talk about food. I know that you turned toward a plant-based diet for your health. Was there a specific incident that inspired you to make the change?
I actually went to Le Cordon Bleu to try to get away from the street life and get away from the addiction, but I didn't have no job. So to make money, you know, I hustled. And so with the addiction and with the different issues, you know, with just the addiction to not just alcohol and using drugs, but the addiction to the fast lifestyle and the partying and the types of people I hung around and the crime, it made it hard for me to stick around because I couldn't pay for it. I was trying to get away from using, and I had a toothache, be honest with you. No regular person is going to take morphine, but I took two morphines. And so I ended up in the hospital with septic shock, and my vials were lost completely, and then they came back. And so after that, I ended up in a program. I went to a Salvation Army program to work on my addictions. And in the program, it was a spiritually based program. I started to read the Bible a lot. I started to do a lot of meditation. And I started to change my ways of eating. I was scared. I didn't want to die. And so I thought the way to prevent that, again, is to obviously leave drugs and alcohol alone, which I never did again after that. And that's been almost 14 years. It'll be 14 years in September. And I was eating a lot of Jack in the Box. And I had the flu. And I kept sneaking Jack in the Box, right? I did like two burgers in one day. And I was like, oh, I'm going to die if I keep eating like this. And so only way that I can stop is eating meat. I said, I'm going to stop eating meat. So I had a flu. The flu stuck around a little longer than I wanted it to, and I watched What the Health, and both my wife and I just decided to stop eating meat and cheese, and I instantly got better.
So Toriano, once you committed to the lifestyle, you decided to open your own place. Tell us about your R&D process and what challenges that you faced.
It's crazy because, be honest with you, once I knew that I was going to start selling the food, something clicked. You know, the first thing that I really, really cooked that was serious was calamari. I took some hearts of palm and I used some seaweed, and I got this recipe off of YouTube, right? And from there, it kind of taught me how to do other things. So gumbo was like my meal that made me actually wanted to open Vegan Mob. And I learned how to make gumbo from making the hearts of palm. I actually took the seaweed idea to make the stuff taste like seafood and put it in my gumbo to get that crab shrimp taste. And I learned little techniques from other vegan chefs, but they have so many replacements now. I always tell people my secret is I use the same exact ingredients, just a plant-based version.
But there's so much out there and so much choice that there must be quite a big variety. So let's talk about certain things specific. For example, for your macaroni and cheese, your vegan mac and cheese, you chose to use pea milk as a substitute for cow's milk or cream. What is it that pea milk gives you?
It tastes like milk. It wasn't sweet. Like most of the vegan milks, when I tried them, they were sweet. Some of the oat milks are kind of thin. People don't like a lot of soy. It was just that pea protein just was like the right fit. It tastes exactly like milk.
One of the things I found so interesting in your Mobby fried chicken recipe was your choice to use a meat substitute that was shredded and then kind of squidge it up together so that when you bite into it, it's more like what it's like to eat a piece of chicken, which isn't a solid thing.
You know, Will, that's because it wasn't available. It wasn't really like, oh yeah, we're gonna just use this. It wasn't available, so we had to make it ourselves. So we chose that version. Now I get the chickens whole. I just create my own batter. And basically that's what we're doing. We're just using a batter and putting it together, and it actually made it look and feel like chicken. Like you said, like not all the way perfect.
Yeah, chicken is very craggy and variable.
Right, right. And I do give that credit to actually my niece who showed me how to put it together like that.
Oh, I love that this is a family thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Toriano.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys having me on. And much love.
That was Toriano Gordon, founder of the restaurant and food truck Vegan Mob. He recently came out with the Vegan Mob cookbook. For his plant-based Mobby fried chicken recipe, head to our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Los Angeles Times restaurant critic Bill Addison is here to take us on a bit of a detour to La Copine, a small but bustling spot in Yucca Valley, perfect for lunch after the Integratron, which is how I first stumbled upon it with my good food colleagues, or bookending sets by Lana Del Rey and Doja Cat during this Coachella weekend. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
What was your first experience of La Copine?
Yeah, it seems like a lifetime ago now, but a decade ago, I was hired as Eater's national critic. And near the end of my time at that job, I was doing a project where I was driving across California and we were naming some of the essential restaurants of California. And my good friend Kim O'Donnell had recently passed through Yucca Valley and urged me to take a detour to La Copine when I was in the Palm Springs area. I was so glad she did, because it was one of the places that really stuck with me from that trip, just for its unexpected location and also its enormous heart.
And there were two dishes that you remember most vividly from that first meal. What were they?
Yeah, they were they were just really comforting and fresh, kind of in the middle of this high desert location. One was a salad featuring smoked salmon and had haricot vert and radishes and fried capers and a poached egg with a beautifully runny yolk. And it felt like, you know, had one foot in Leon and the other in Santa Monica. And then the other was fried chicken, which is one of my favorite things in the world. And the chef had used potato flour for like a very specific crackle. And she served it over peppery cheddar grits. And yeah, maybe it was my Southern roots, but that it really like felt like home eating that dish.
You resist calling La Copine an oasis, and instead you opt for the word refuge. Who's behind the restaurant, and how did they meet?
Nikki Hill is the chef, and Claire Wadsworth oversees the front of the house. They're the owners. They met in Philadelphia in 2009, I think. They fell in love after meeting at a dinner that Nikki was catering, and they relocated to Los Angeles 3 years later. And several years after that, they married and they went to the desert for one of their first trips as a married couple. And you mentioned the Integraton. They were visiting that structure. And about 6 miles away was this long-standing vacant diner space. And they saw it, they bought it, they moved nearby, and they opened the restaurant 6 months later.
I love that story. What are some of the characteristics of Chef Nikki Hill's cooking?
Yeah, so I said when I wrote about it again for the LA Times recently that you can taste in her cooking the joy of someone devising dishes and leading her own crew after years of working for others. The menu is very straightforward and friendly. Salads, sandwiches, vegetable plates, several entrees. But there's just really something. She's one of those chefs where you taste her food once and you kind of get it. She loves kind of combining like creamy ingredients among crisper and crunchier textures in a really kind of specific way. And she's great with the jolts of acid. And I've said this before, but it just keeps coming up that there's just a lot of heart in her cooking. And it's one reason that I keep La Copine in my mind.
There is a constant bustle of guests. I know that when the Good Food team went there, when we went on our camping excursion, mm-hmm. which we documented, it was packed and we had to wait for a table. What hours does the restaurant keep, and what is the best approach to getting a table?
Yeah, so they are open 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Thursdays through Sundays, and they close in the hottest months of the year. They offer reservations in a limited number by texting a number that they list on their website. And if you don't snag one of those limited reservations, which plenty of people don't, locals and visitors alike just show up to wait. And there's a big patio that they built during the pandemic, and it's just kind of a vibe to hang out and wait for your meal as well, kind of particularly after you've made this journey to get to the restaurant. It's worth the wait.
Yeah, because if we're not locals, really we're out there because we've day tripped or we're making a weekend somewhere. Do you have any suggestions for how we do that? Like be a little tourist guide for us?
Sure. Well, I will say, you know, it's probably a couple hours or more from Los Angeles proper to drive out there for a day trip. So just keep that in mind. If you're spending the night in the Palm Springs area, it's 45 minutes. Certainly, it is an ideal fortifying meal for a hike afterwards. in Joshua Tree National Park, which is not far. And I know plenty of people who get up very early to take that hike instead. So La Copine would be a great meal after. There are a couple other restaurants in the area, which of course is becoming so popular. Snakebite Roadhouse is another fun restaurant not far if you want to plan for dinner, if you're going to La Copine for lunch, which is what the hours kind of lean toward. There's another place called Kitchen in the Desert, which has kind of Trinidadian flavors, including some very good oxtails. Yeah, make a day out of it.
How fun. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan. Always great to talk with you.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison. Headed to Coachella this year? Check out La Copine in Yucca Valley. To find a link to Bill's review, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, my first love may be apple pie, but boysenberry, that is a close second. In honor of this year's brand new berry pie category at our upcoming pie contest, I invited pie pro Clémence Deloutes to share tips on making a juicy but not runny berry pie. Stay close. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. My earliest pie memory involves boysenberry pie at Knott's Berry Farm. The berry pie became an obsession, first as an eater, then as a neophyte pie maker. Mrs. Smith was definitely involved. It's a large category with a ton of variety, so I'm pleased it's one of our new categories at Pie Fest. Here to parse all the ways to make them is Clémence Deloutes of Gourmandise Cooking School. Hi, Clémence.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Are we ready? Are we getting excited?
We are ready. I am so ready. I'm in Morro Bay right now consulting with pie for a coffee shop over here and croissant. But the countdown is real. We are so excited about the Pie Fest.
So let's talk about berries. First, we have to acknowledge all the kinds. So there are multiple types of blackberries, strawberries, blueberries, and even mulberries, although they won't be in season for the contest. Have I left any out?
I think you've listed all of them that are readily available right now. I think at Farmer's Market, we're getting a lot of really great blueberries starting this month. And that's what I would be playing with the most. But I have seen some good raspberries lately.
Is there a template for making berry pie fillings, or do we need to consider the ins and outs of each berry?
So the template really, there are three. So there are three ways that I think about berry pies. One of them is a pre-cooked filling. Another one would be cooking the berries into the pie, but not pre-cooking the filling. And the third is the idea of like a fresh berry pie. Like you mentioned, Mrs. Smith's, like the thing I think about is the Marie Callender's fresh strawberry pie, where you're piling the fruit into a pre-baked crust and you have this sort of matrix of goop. And it sounds unappetizing, but it's very delicious. And I'll talk to you how to make it in a little bit. But sort of holding everything together. So do you want to do a deep dive into the three?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the three. You and I have always been, had a friendly arguments about to pre-cook. You're a big believer in pre-cooking pie filling. In the past, I've always been, no, I have to do it the old-fashioned way where it cooks inside the pie. But after talking to flavor scientist Ariel Johnson about the benefits of pre-cooking, of getting more flavor in there, I might be open to it. So tell us, first of all, how to go about it and why you choose to do one over the other.
Well, I like to pre-cook the fruit because I know that I've got just the right amount of starch. So when we're making pie filling, it's sort of the opposite of making jam. When we make jam, we're creating a thick, beautiful puree of fruit by reducing water content in a pan. When we're making pie filling, we're taking all of that moisture that's in the fruit, and instead of cooking it out, we're absorbing it with a bunch of starch. And that starch, if you're making apple or peach pie, is probably going to be flour. And if you're doing something like a blueberry pie, it's a good idea to use a slurry of starch. So when I am pre-cooking my fruit, I do it with this little trick that I learned from teaching with you, and I think you picked up from Dorothy Reinhold, which is to take a blueberry. So most fruit pies are made up of 2.5 to 3 pounds of fruit. So when I'm doing my cooked blueberry filling, I'll take 2 pounds of blueberries and I'll cook them into this like pot without stirring too much until the water and the juice from the fruit leaches out. And then I make a slurry of water and cornstarch. So I use 2 parts water to 1 part cornstarch. For a pie, I'll start with about 1/4 cup of water and 2 tablespoons of starch and stir them up. And then I pour that a spoonful at a time into the pot holding the blueberries that are bubbling. And as soon as it starts to thicken, I turn off the heat right away. I pour all of this out into a sheet pan so it cools quickly, and I add about 1 pound of fresh blueberries on top so that we have a mixture of cooked and fresh blueberries in different textures, and then wait for it to cool and then taste and adjust the seasoning. And that's because typically you're eating a pie once it's cooled, ideally, which I know is so hard to do. But I want to taste the filling as I would be eating it later. So that's when I'll add more lemon, always a pinch of salt, sugar, whatever it is that enhances the fruit.
So what you've just described is the way that I make my raw blueberry pies, Dorothy's recipe. So that becomes the base. And then I just lay a bunch of raw blueberries on top, and it never gets cooked again. But with this method, that filling that you have pre-cooked goes into the pie. Let's say it's a double crust pie or a lattice pie, and it goes into the oven, right?
That's right. It goes into the oven. And once it comes out of the oven, then you know that your pie is going to be sliceable. And you also know that it's going to taste great because you've sort of already tasted what's going into the oven.
And it'll be much faster because really the only part of that pie that you're cooking is the crust.
Correct. So it's a little bit more foolproof in that way. If I'm going to take raw blueberries, I'll take 2.5 to 3 pounds of them. And then I usually use about 1/4 cup or 35 grams or so of cornstarch for every pound of berries. Kind of toss it all together with sugar, a little salt, maybe a little lemon juice or zest, and then put that in the raw crust. And I'll add either crumble on top or the second pie dough.
Now, what about spices and berries? Is that a yes or a no? I mean, would you add cinnamon? Would you use any other spices when you're making a pie from any of these berries, or do you think they don't need it?
I say always respect the fruit first, but I do have to say that last year's winner in the children's category was made with blueberries and cinnamon. And typically the amount of cinnamon that's used, it like masks everything else, and that's kind of all you taste. But he was pretty masterful. I like to use spices that really sort of enhance. So when I'm doing blueberry pie, I'll do sort of a little bit of ginger because it makes it kind of zingy. I like using sumac with strawberries. Black pepper is really great. So just something that's not going to take over, but just kind of add a little pop.
So let's talk about strawberries. I have to admit that I'm not a huge fan of cooked strawberries.
Yeah.
So I tend to pair them with another fruit. Like, there's the traditional rhubarb, but I also love a strawberry raspberry pie.
Mm-hmm. I really like to do a raw fruit pie when I'm doing the strawberries, and that's when I would add the raspberry. I don't love doing mixed berries because I want to be able to taste it instead of just like a mashup. So for the raw berry pie, I make a slurry. Also, it's that like beautiful goop that kind of ties everything together, and I'll flavor that. You can flavor that with like elderflower or a little champagne or a little sumac, and then raspberries are great because they fill in all the holes that some of the larger strawberries can create and give you, you know, a sense of how each of them taste without them all being cooked and mashed up together.
Oh, that's so interesting. Since bakers can't use dairy this year, except for sour cream, which is allowed, what are some strategies for making a pie that's not just berries, sugar, and thickener?
I like to put in a little bit of syrup or jam, sort of as a ribbon within your berry pie. That's really fun to do. You can add some really interesting flavors to a crumble. A berry pie does really, really well with crumble because some of the starch from this crumble can absorb the juices. So if I'm making a rhubarb pie or, you know, a berry pie that's like extra juicy, like let's say a blackberry pie, a crumble is really, really good. And you can add all sorts of things to the crumble to make it extra little bit tangy or nutty or oaty. And that's a really fun thing to play with.
Yeah, and sometimes if I'm making a berry pie, like a blackberry pie, for example, I'll put dollops of sour cream on top of my berries and then top that with crumble. Ooh. And so when it cooks, you get this kind of yummy, kind of Danish-y thing kind of happening on the top of the pie.
Oh my God, that sounds great.
I can't believe that we still like pie.
I love pie. It's like a vessel for everything that's really special about what grows here.
So good. Thank you so, much, Clemence.
Thank you so much. This has been so fun, and I'm really excited about April 28th and can't wait to taste pie.
That was Clemence DeLutz. Need some personal instruction on making a flaky pie crust or getting those berries just so? Clemence and her instructors at the Gourmandise School have got you. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood for a link and find the class that is right for you. Clemence will be joining us on Sunday, April 28th at UCLA for KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and Contest. Will you be there? There is still time for bakers to enter the contest and impress the judges with your own spin on berry pie. Once again, this year's judges list is an impressive who's who of food in LA, including bakers like Clemence, Hannah Ziskin, Nicole Rucker, Shannon Swindle, and journalists like Gustavo Arellano and Tejal Rao. And did you hear that public radio icon? Ira Glass is going to be a judge this year. It's just too cool for school. Public radio and pie. It's a winning combination, and it's all happening on April 28th at UCLA. Whether you want to enter a pie and compete or just come and enjoy the marketplace, the music, and the beer hall, go to kcrw.com/pie to enter or to RSVP as a guest. Sure, you know almonds, but do you know green almonds? The market report is on deck. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Let's head now to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where spring keeps on giving. Jillian Ferguson is there now with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. When we talk about seasonal produce here on the Farmers Market Report, sometimes that means that we're talking about an item that can only be in the market for a few weeks before it's gone. And one of those hyper-seasonal, short-lived ingredients in California is the green almond. Here to tell us all about these fuzzy fruits is Justin Siemens of Fat Uncle Farms. Hi.
Hi, thanks, Jillian.
Well, great to see you. So I just called these a fruit, but I realize that might be a misnomer. What exactly botanically is going on with these green almonds?
Technically, they're a drupe. They're closely related to apricots and peaches in that they will develop the pit. But with almonds, the kernel or seed is what the part we eat instead of the actual, you know, with the peach or almond, you would think the fruit is the flesh. But on the almond, that dries out and we take it off.
That makes a lot of sense because to the untrained eye, these look almost more like unripe little peaches than they do almonds.
That's right. They're really, really similar to unripe peaches and apricots, and similar flavor profile also. Bitter, kind of tart, crunchy. Yeah.
They're sort of the soft green sage color. They are fuzzy on the outside. At this point, when they're pretty young, can you eat the whole thing?
Yeah, that's right. At the beginning of the green almond season, you can eat the whole thing. And over the next couple weeks, they'll start to develop and dry out. And at a certain point, you won't be able to eat the whole thing, but you can still crack it open and eat the kernel.
And you mentioned that they're tart. Kind of describe the experience of eating these.
So one thing that I've noticed is a lot of different people from primarily the Mediterranean region consider it a delicacy, and they'll eat it in different ways. And so if you just eat the whole thing, it's very crunchy, very tart. And some people will crack it open and just eat the kernel at this point. And that's completely different. It's not tart at all. It's very soft. And it's almost, I've had it described like a cucumber or a grape.
Yeah, the texture of the immature almond inside is so interesting. It's almost jelly-like.
Yeah, that's right. It's really totally different almond experience, and it's really good. I had one customer tell me he likes to pop them open and put the kernels in green tea. Almost like a boba tea.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I've also heard of people putting them on ice cream or even putting them in jams too.
Yeah, those are all really popular. At this point where they're still edible, some chefs will blanch them and then pickle them or slice them into salads. I've had people tell me they like to slice them on and roast fish with it or chicken.
So as the season progresses, what happens to this outer sort of fruit around the almond?
So similar to a peach or an apricot, the outer part of the peach or apricot is the fruiting part. On an almond, that's going to separate and dry out into what we call the husk. And it gets like leathery almost and pretty hard. And that will fall off typically, or, you know, when we actually harvest in late July, early August for the regular almonds, then those get removed at the hull or sheller.
Justin, how has harvesting the green almonds actually changed your farming practices?
So harvesting the green almonds is, it's hand harvested, and we actually can only harvest the lower parts of the trees because we're doing it by hand. And so we've started to trim some of the trees specifically for green almond harvesting, and that allows us to interplant a lot more varieties of plants inside because there's less coverage from the trees. The trees are shorter, so we can plant a lot more in between there, and it's great for, you know, the biodiversity of our orchard and for, you know, keeping the land more productive. It's really good for the soil. So yeah, it's made a big difference in those kinds of operations. And we haven't done that to the whole orchard. Right now we've just started on kind of a test plot on one side, but we're hoping to expand that even more and do more green almonds in the future.
So fascinating. Well, how much longer can we enjoy the green almonds this season?
I would say probably another 3 to 4 weeks, you know, maybe 2 weeks where they're soft and then a couple more weeks after that. But we're going to keep bringing them until people don't want it because there's so many people who enjoy it in different ways. So we want to be able to bring it for them.
So awesome. Thank you so much, Justin.
Thank you.
That was Justin Siemens of Fat Uncle Farms. You can find his certified organic green almonds as well as his regular almonds every week at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market, the Saturday Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and the Sunday Hollywood Market. As Justin just said, green almonds are well known across the Mediterranean and specifically in the Persian community where they're prepared in a number of different ways. And I'm so very happy that chefs Cody Ma and Misha Cesar of the Iranian restaurant Azizam in Silver Lake agreed to come share some inspiration on how to enjoy them. Hello, you two.
Hi.
Hi, so happy to be here.
Thanks for coming all this way. So did either of you grow up with green almonds in your household in the springtime?
We both did, actually.
It was always such a treat because I grew up in Nebraska, so it wasn't something that we always had available. But there was a specialty store that my mom would go to, and she would always be like, if you can get this for us, please let me know. And so whenever it was like, you knew it was the height of spring when you would come home and like on the coffee table, there was just this like little bowl of the green almonds. And I was like, oh, it's like finally springtime.
And how would your mom prepare them?
It's very simple. You know, usually it's just as is with a little bit of salt. Sometimes you'd squeeze a little bit of lemon juice, crack them, and like really delicious, like just raw.
And what about you, Misha?
Basically the same. My dad would be super excited to have both the green almonds and then goje, which is the green gauge plums, which are the mark of springtime. We would eat them with salt or just by themselves. They have that like fuzzy outside texture, and the interior is like really jello-y, super like crisp, a little bitter, and really green. Yeah.
So is it eaten sort of as a snack with a tea or something?
Yeah, it's a snack time thing, you know, usually in the afternoon, just something like a little bit refreshing, especially after school, really enjoyable with tea or like various other like fruits and like, you know, vegetables like Persian cucumbers.
And when you say eaten with salt, would you just have like a little bowl of salt next to them and you dip it in?
Yes. Yeah, so the move would be like your first bite you would take and then you would dip it in salt afterwards. And then you just keep doing that throughout the process. And then the same thing too, there would be like slices of lemon or lime if you want to add a little bit more acidity, even though it is quite tart, but Persians just love that like brightness to everything. So it really adds that extra flavor to it.
That's so awesome. So I've read a bunch of different ways to use them online. Some people will maybe brine them, pickle them. I've heard about some different stews. Have you guys experimented at all?
My grandma has made the stew before. It's not something that we usually would do just because we didn't have a lot of it available. So it was like, just enjoy it. It's like the peak freshness. But you can braise it in a stew. It still retains some of its crunchiness. But usually the stew is like with mint, parsley, a lot of like lemon juice, and then like lamb or like beef. And it was also very delicious as well.
So you're about a month into your brick and mortar at Azizam in Silver Lake. Do you think we'll see any of these show up on the menu before the season leaves?
Maybe not this year, just because we're still dialing things in. But I mean, the whole thing with Azizam is we really want to highlight the seasonality of Iranian cuisine. It's really important to showcase that just beyond, you know, the normal stews that you might find at most places. So hopefully, you know, maybe next year we could do something with it. But for now, we're just going to enjoy it as much as we can at home.
Can you give us a little sneak peek of what's on the menu that you're excited about right now?
We're actually testing out tachin, which is golden crispy rice cakes. Those are really delicious. We're probably going to pair it with a seasonal stew. We haven't decided which one we're going to do yet. We're also really excited for spinach right now, too. So we're probably going to put on our spinach yogurt dip as a borani, which we're really excited about, too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Cody Ma and Misha Cesar, partners behind the Iranian restaurant Azizam in Silver Lake. They are open for lunch and dinner Thursday through Sunday. And on Mondays, they're open for dinner only. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush and Sue Margulies, and a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'm going to say it one more time. Whether you're a baker or an eater, mark your calendar for April 28th and go to kcrw.com/pie to enter or to RSVP for this year's Pie Fest and contest. I'll meet you back here next week for another episode of Good Food.